From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This weekend, there were more big protests across the country in response to the deaths of African-American men and boys and encounters with police. But while many people addressed the issue in the streets, many faced it in the pews. A number of churches observed what they called Black Lives Matter Sunday. It's part of a tradition of history of addressing the important challenges of life through prayer. We're looking at the story now through a collection of 2 centuries of African-American prayer. This hour, On Point, Conversations with God Across the Generations. You can join us on air or online. We'd love to know about the role that prayer plays in your life. Is prayer a part of how you deal with private struggles? What about public concerns? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Indianapolis is Quentin Dixie. He is a professor of religious studies and director of the Ethnic and Cultural Studies Program at Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne. He was a close colleague of the late James Melvin Washington, the historian and minister who put together the collection of prayers called Conversations with God, 2 centuries of prayers by African Americans. Originally published 2 decades ago, it is now out in a new edition. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Quentin Dixie, welcome to On Point. Thanks for coming.
Hello, Michelle.
How did this collection come about? I noticed that you were mentioned in the preface as having pushed, encouraged Reverend Washington to put the collection together. Why did you think it was important?
Well, much of the book was already done when I came across it. I was a research assistant for Professor Washington at Union Theological Seminary, and one of my jobs was to organize his papers, his books. And one day I came across this file folder marked Conversations with God. I looked in it, and he had all these prayers, some handwritten on yellow paper, some typed out. I asked him about the next day, and he said, something I've been working on for a while. I'm not done yet. But when I looked at it, I said, this is done. And so from that point, we started pushing towards publication.
Well, why do you think it's important, though? Why did you think this was something that really had to be brought out?
Well, I think prayer is one of those things that's been central to the African-American religious experience as a way of expressing the pains, the hopes, the joys, the despair. And it was an opportunity, in the words of Dr. Washington, to show how one can endure suffering without having their joy spoiled. Hmm. And so for him, it was very important to make that point and show that this is not an opportunity to privilege pain, but a way that to show how African-American pain and suffering and religious experience in general can transcend race and be a gift to America.
Well, what is prayer? Might seem like a silly question to you, but for some might not have a personal experience with this. What is prayer in your view?
Well, as defined by this book, prayer is simply conversations with God. And we keep it intentionally broad. So we include things that seem to be a conversation with God that are actually hymns or songs, poems. It can be something that is rather formulaic, where someone prays in a particular way routinely. Unfortunately, this book, for the most part, just covers African-American religious experience. But other religious experiences have routines that involve prayer. So what we tried to cover is a broad gamut, but prayer, in its base sense, is this conversation with God that we're talking about.
Now, a lot of people think of prayer as private petitions, you know, please help me, please be with me in this moment. But there are a lot of public prayers here as well, clearly prayers that were meant to be kind of publicly uttered as part of a group experience. How did you decide what to include? In fact, the collection includes both, and many of them, the private prayers particularly, I think, or what seem to be private prayers, are very, very moving. How did you decide what to include?
Well, one of the things we wanted to do is to try to find prayers that helped us tell the story of the African-American experience. And so that was the first organizing criteria. Some of them, like you said, are public. Some of them are actually private. Some of them are said in public, but said in such a way that they are overheard by others with the intent of getting a particular point across that might be painful or problematic to do so in private.
Hmm. I'm going to ask you to read one. Would you mind? Can you start with... do you have a copy of the book with you?
Yes, I
hope.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't, in fact, memorized it by now. But I'd like you to start with a short one, A Slave Woman's Prayer. And this is from 1816.
Oh, sure. Okay. Oh, Lord, bless my master. When he calls upon thee to damn his soul, do not hear him. Do not hear him, but hear me. Save him. Make him know he is wicked, and he will pray to thee. I am afraid, O Lord, I have wished him bad wishes in my heart. Keep me from wishing him bad, though he whips me and beats me sore. Tell me of my sins, and make me pray more to thee. Make me more glad for what thou hast done for me, a poor Negro.
Now, this is remarkable. I mean, it has so many, there's so much to this. Tell us a little bit about this, if you would. And it is credited to Stephen Hayes, who is a minister. How did this come to be known as a slave woman's prayer? What can you tell us?
Right. And what we have for a lot of these prayers are prayers that have been written down by individuals who overheard these prayers either in a worship service or some kind of worship experience. And so because they were able to recount and actually document these prayers, we actually have them today. This particular prayer is interesting because I can imagine the scenario where you might have a mixed audience in a worship service. And so this woman making this public plea, perhaps even in front of whites, pleading for her master's soul. Doing so in that venue makes it safe space for her to make those kinds of claims. So it's a way almost of, you know, empowerment, not only spiritually, but, you know, actually in her own temporal situation as well.
And it's remarkable because it's a petition for his soul, but also for her to be accountable for her own sins. I think some people might find that remarkable, that someone in such a situation, I think most people now understand what a dire circumstance slavery was for enslaved people. I think, you know, perhaps the cotton has been taken away from people's eyes about it, you know, just sort of a benign institution. I think people for all kinds of reasons are becoming acquainted with kind of the reality of it as this dehumanizing circumstance. Why do you think, I'm asking for an opinion here, but why do you think she's praying for both his soul, but for accountability for herself? And why do you think that's important?
I think ultimately for her, that's where she is empowered. She gets a sense of herself as a person who is in some ways superior. And I think that's one thing you have to watch here is the lapse into kind of moral superiority. But, you know, I can be a good person. I can be a strong Christian despite my circumstances as long as I don't allow them to drag me down. How do I not allow this to get me to the level of hate? And you can easily see how the situation could do so. So she's struggling with that herself. But also to pray for her master, because as a Christian, she feels obligated to make sure that, you know, she is a good witness. And in being a good witness, she helps bring others to Christ, even those who are in that position of control over her.
There's another poem by Harriet Jacobs, a piteous prayer to a hidden God. And this is in the form of her recounting of something that she heard at a Methodist class meeting. And she's recounting something she heard another congregant say at that meeting. Do you have that? And would you please read?
Oh, yes, I like this one.
Yes, please read the second paragraph. Well, actually, it's a bit long. So just to set it up for you, that she says she went with a burdened spirit and she happened to sit next to a poor bereaved mother whose heart was heavier. And then the class leader was the town constable, a man who bought and sold slaves, who whipped his brethren and sisters of the church at the public whipping post in jail or out of jail. And he was ready to perform that Christian office anywhere for 50 cents. And then she says that she then turned to the stricken woman and said, Sister, tell us how the Lord deals with your soul. Do you love him? And this is, and now I'm going to ask you to tell us what she said.
She rose to her feet and said in piteous tones, My Lord and Master, help me. My load is more than I can bear. God has hid himself from me, and I am left in darkness and misery. Then striking her breast, she continued, I can't tell you what is in here. They've got all my children. Last week they took the last one. God only knows where they've sold her. They let me have her 16 years, and then, oh, pray for her, brothers and sisters. I've got nothing to live for. God, make my time short. She sat down, quivering every limb.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the importance of this. Harriet Jacobs was a woman who actually escaped from slavery, one of those remarkable stories that had been kind of hidden for a long time and then became known, was very famous in her time, then was her story was kind of lost for a while and then reemerged, you know, some years ago, of how she hid literally in an attic for 7 years so that she wouldn't be sold away from her children and then found her way to freedom. Tell us about the importance of this briefly, if you would.
The thing I really like about this prayer is that Harriet Jacobs tells us she came to church feeling down and encountered somebody who had it worse than she did. How often is that the experience that we have? Just as we start to wallow in self-pity, we encounter somebody who's got it worse than we do. So she kind of sets up the poem and the prayer in that way by suggesting that, you know, she came there with this certain kind of feeling and left recognizing that her problems within the context of what was going on in other people's lives wasn't as great as she thought. But yet, you know, another thing that's interesting to me is that this woman, having all her children taken from her, has asked God to make her time on this life short, in this world short, right? Because she can't bear the experience of living without her children. So, you know, she would rather that God take her.
Very vivid, very powerful. Quentin Dixie, I'm going to ask you to stay with us. We're talking about the history of African-American prayer. These prayers have been collected in a book called Conversations with God, which has now been reissued. It was collected by James Washington, and Quentin Dixie worked with him as his research associate. We are going out now with a choral arrangement of Lord Rebuke Thy Servant Not by Charles Price Jones. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the history of African-American prayer. You can join the conversation. If you are a regular worshiper, do you want to hear reflections on the issues of the day when you worship? What did you hear this weekend? We're joined this hour by Quentin Dixie, director of the Ethnic and Cultural Studies Program at Indiana University, Purdue University at Fort Wayne. He's a close colleague of the late James Melvin Washington, editor of the collection Conversations with God, Two Centuries of Prayers by African Americans. But I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Pastor Willis Johnson joins us now from Ferguson, Missouri, where he is pastor of the Wellspring Church. He was very active in trying to offer a spiritual presence during the protests around the death of Michael Brown. His church has hosted community conversations during the recent events, and he's become a big voice in the national conversation around these issues. And Pastor Willis Johnson, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thank you.
I asked Professor Dixie this, so I thought I'd like to ask you this. What is prayer?
Well, I am a follower and a faithful student of Dr. Washington and Dr. Dixon's work with Conversations with God, and I articulate in the same way that it's simply our exchange, our community, our conversation with God, and it takes on a lot of different shapes and forms and varied expressions, but fundamentally it's us engaging God and God engaging us.
You know, this weekend marked more protests around the issues that were raised by the deaths of Michael Brown and other African-American men and boys in police custody. And of course, you and your congregation, your community have been at the center of this. You've been living with this for quite some time. I noticed that you preached on this past Sunday. What did you say? What were you thinking about when you were putting your thoughts together?
Well, continuously, we have to look at the situations around us and understand how our faith helps us to either reconcile or to redress those concerns and realities. And so, you know, Black Lives Matter. At the same time, how do we particularly in this community not only celebrate and affirm for people of color, African Americans, the sanctity of our life, the sacredness of our personhood, while inviting and invoking others into that same practice. And so the story of Schiffer and Pua in Exodus, where they are called kind of outsiders, kind of bridgers within the communities of the oppressor and the oppressed, take a very direct civil disobedient kind of stance and begin to work in the preservation and the rebuilding or the sustainability and the sacredness of persons through their office. And that was the challenge that has that came out of the chant, Black Lives Matter, and the refrain, All Lives Matter. And that's what we're trying to continuously do, not only here in Ferguson, but beyond.
Well, it's actually, just to be a little bit more plain about this, Shipra and Pua were midwives, and they were enlisted to participate in the Exodus story in killing Hebrew boys. And they found a way not to do this by saying that, the Hebrew women, they are delivering before we get there, so we couldn't possibly do that. And what was your intention in bringing forth this story? What point are you making?
Well, I think it's important that as you do the exegesis and you really study, I think we take for granted the personhood and the identity and the cultural connection between Shifra and Pua to both either the oppressor or the oppressed. They were probably not midwives that were Hebrews or Israelites because they couldn't be trusted by the government. And they wouldn't have been very well respected or trusted by those expecting mothers if they were part of their oppressor's full-out regime. And so we know because of their names, they had kind of a hybrid cultural and ethnic or geographic, in this case, particularly a geographic presence. And so here are some folks who kind of stand in the crossroads of this, somewhat engaged, maybe their livelihoods at stake, their own lives, themselves and their families, but then also people who are sympathetic to the cause. They're no more free in some instances than those that are oppressed. And really there's more of us standing in that kind of intersection of our ethical, spiritual, cultural reality in situations like this than we allude to. And I think it's one of those places within our faith tradition, and particularly within the scriptural narrative, where we can raise a question and investigate what is really an ethical dilemma for so many of us in times like these.
It's actually a fairly tough message, Pastor Johnson, if you don't mind my say so. You were nice enough to send us a copy of the sermon this morning. And it is not an easy message, you know, at all. It gets some very bracing circumstances described in that, and I have to, you know, ask you about that. Is that something that you hesitate over in any way, or do you feel that you know, conversations don't all have to be affirming? I think many people think of prayer as something that is of comfort, that brings comfort to people, and this, I think, you're really posing more of a challenge.
I think, yes, you're correct. I think that I hold dearly to the quote of Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who says we wrestle with God or we worship God through our questions, and that wrestling, I think, is imperative. We see it in scriptural accounts where Jacob wrestles with God, says, I'm not going to let you go until you help me understand this thing. And there's some situations where God is going to remind us that this is not for you to know at this time, or, you know, this is not something I have to respond to. But I think prayer should not be limited to just this cosmic kind of genie and bellhop where we just make petitions and ask for stuff and wait for it to come, nor should it just in and of itself be a place where we lay all our burdens and concerns and say, fix it, but allow us to be challenged and made over and instilled with the tools and the resources or the means. And I think even in the prayers that have been previously highlighted and the ones that have encouraged me in my practice of prayer from conversations with God over the years, I think that liberty, that latitude, that almost ambiguous but yet spacious nature of what prayer can be at any moment, at any time, for anyone, is the beauty of it. And yes, the spoken word, the preached word, the scriptural narrative is not always clean and easy. The language is not always politically correct. That term Hebrew was not a term of endearment. It became one because that was what foreigners and outsiders called the Israelite people. And in turn, when they described themselves to the outsiders, to the oppressor, mm-hmm. they used the terminology heaped upon them by the oppressor. Okay. We still have those elements of that today, and I think people have to understand, not only in theoethics, but just in their everyday living, how language and how their experiences are in interplay, and how this is not a new thing, but this is part of the historical continuum.
Well, speaking of that, Professor Dixie, can you think of a prayer from the collection that speaks to the present moment in a similar way? I mean, you hear that Pastor Johnson here was kind of grappling from a religious perspective, recognizing, of course, that not everyone is religious or shares the faith tradition represented in these prayers and also Reverend Johnson's. But is there a prayer in the collection that you can think of that speaks to the sense of things happening right now, things happening right then in a public way that someone wanted to speak to through prayer?
Well, one thing I really like about what Reverend Johnson said was about the wrestling that takes place. The previous prayer that we read, Prayer to a Hidden God, kind of gives us that sense, right? Because there's a sense of God forsakenness. In the midst of her suffering, she's asking the question, where is God? Why is God not making God's self present in a more powerful way? And sometimes we feel uncomfortable asking those kinds of questions. But Reverend Johnson is suggesting that, indeed, we need to wrestle in that way. I like this prayer by Du Bois, Give Us Grace.
Yes.
Could you give us just one or two lines of it, please?
Sure. Give us grace, O God, to dare to do the deed which we well know cries to be done. Let us not hesitate because of ease or the words of men's mouths or our own lives. Mighty causes are calling us. The freeing of women, the training of children, the putting down of hate and murder and poverty, all these and more. But they call with voices that mean work and sacrifice and death. Mercifully grant us, O God, the spirit of Esther, that we say, I will go unto the king, and if I perish, I perish.
Hmm. Let's ask some of our callers to participate in our conversation. I'd like to hear what's on their minds. Daniel, are you with us? You're calling from Miami, Florida. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to, I'm listening to these prayers, and as a non-religious individual, I find them very, very selfless, and it's very insightful almost to the time and age. And I just want to, what are your thoughts on how that's reflected on today's, quote-unquote, post-segregated era, though we're still seeing much of the same discrimination, and I'm pretty sure if, you know, we were able to, it would fall back in reverse and everything would start up again.
Daniel, tell a little bit more about what's on your mind. Are you saying that you find it hard to believe that people would pray these prayers today?
No. Well, yeah, because I'm I come from a very, very, my background, my mother's very, very, very Christian. My father's very free spirited. And so I kind of came from both worlds of not really necessarily falling into religion, but definitely it being presented. And I'm listening to the prayer of a slave woman. That one's the one that completely ignited my thoughts. And it made me start thinking, it's like these people were, you know, being treated as property and material and, you know, less than anything. And they weren't even counted as an individual. And yet they still had it in their hearts and in their souls to pray for the people who are doing this horrid thing to them. And nowadays, people don't look at it the same way. They're looking at it like, okay, you did me bad or you did something ill to me or mine, and I'm looking for retribution. I'm looking for vengeance. I'm just trying to see, what are your thoughts on how we could promote this selflessness in today's day and age, pretty much?
Well, Pastor Johnson, I'm going to ask you to take that question first because you've been right in the thick of it. I mean, you were literally standing between, you know, protesters and law enforcement, you know, at certain points earlier in the year, some very tense moments, literally putting yourself, your body in the middle and offering yourself, if I can use those terms, to try to ameliorate, you know, the tensions that we saw. What do you say to Daniel, who said that I don't know that I see people wanting to take on that spirit of I don't know, what am I even looking for, acquiescence or...
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's the beauty of the faith that we understand even when others don't value us, the value of them. This continual a theme of sacredness of persons, the humanity, and even in this particular reference, the deity. I mean, seeing God in all. The one thing that we don't often lift up is that these men and women who were brought over from another place did not learn their faith here. it was shaped and further fortified. But the faith of the indigenous and of the African was not one that was polytheistic as many perceived. They believed in God. They believed in a God that was in everything and in everywhere. There was no division between the sacred and the profane, or the sacred and the secular. In all things, in all people, even those who spoke profanity against him, there was still a profound presence of God that would prevail over them and through their situation. And so I think that sense of hope and assurance of the presence of God, the power of God, the purposes of God, even in these things that were meant for evil, that God somehow would make them become good, this is what I believe is the echoing of the inherent spirit that dwelled in them. And so we see that across the continent with the Igbo people, who before there was an expression defined by the Academy of the Trinity, they had the Mkulu-Kulu and the Chi and the Chai. They had the three-dimensional God, the great big God, Mkulu-Kulu. So I think we have to celebrate and acknowledge that that is what is resonant. That is what is being expressed and heard, and what we all have to, I think, mine for in this day of manufacturing ministry, making up stuff, over-intellectualizing. Sometimes we need to get to the depth of it, the purest form of it, and that sense of humanity and deity. Particularly, the deity within humanity, I believe, is what we strive for. And we can call it a lot of different things and practice it in a lot of different ways. We're so caught up in religion that we don't, sometimes don't understand the spiritual depth that we all have, even though we cannot give name or formalize practice to it.
Okay, I think we're going to take a short break in a moment. And when we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit more about prayer that comes outside of the Christian tradition. I'd love to hear from people who are practice outside of the Christian tradition and what their thoughts are about this. But before we go, I want to hear from Megan. Megan is calling from Whitman, Massachusetts. Megan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for taking my call. I just was calling to say that I pray. I feel like I pray for everything. I say thank you when I get a good parking spot or anything during the day, but also when I am experiencing difficulties, I feel that I don't, I know God is present in helping me, or I wouldn't be getting through what my issue is.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And before we let you go, Pastor Johnson, I know you have to get back to your other duties, and thanks for joining us today. But we've talked a lot about public utterances, you know, in the wake of the events that have captured so much of our attention in the country. But there are also private, you know, petitions. Even as all this was going on, as Megan was reminding us, there are people who would say, look, you know, my dad is sick and I can't take care of him at home anymore. This is a challenge for me. I can't get my kids the Christmas presents I want them to have. And this is hurting to me. How do you decide between talking about the things that are big in the world and the things that are important in people's own personal lives? I mean, is there anything wrong with asking God to help you with Christmas presents or a parking space? Pastor Johnson? Mm-hmm.
No, not at all. I mean, I think that's the latitude and the liberty that is offered to us, understanding that at the end of the day, that there is a greater will and power and agency. If we recognize the source and the sustenance or the sustaining nature of the supplier of those things, then we also understand in comparison to the at least particularly in our practice, that if we are offering ourselves over to that belief that there is a greater strength, power, or presence, then we also surrender ourselves to the reality or the notion that thy will, that agency may super rule, veto, or affirm and concur with what it is that we're looking for.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Pastor Johnson, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Oh, thank you so much.
Willis Johnson is pastor of the Wellspring Church in Ferguson, Missouri. I'm going to ask Quentin Dixie to stay with us. We're talking about the history of African-American prayer. We're talking about how it informs the conversations about the big issues of the day, as well as our private concerns. We're going to go out now with a recording from the 1920s, Standing in the Need of Prayer, by the CNMA Gospel Singers. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Forgive me, it's me, oh Lord.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the history of African-American prayer and how it informs the conversations about the big issues of the day. You can join the conversation. Do you draw on the religious language of whatever your own tradition may be? Are there limits to what can be expressed in the language of faith? We're joined this hour by Quentin Dixie, director of the Ethnic and Cultural Studies Program at Indiana University, Purdue University at Fort Wayne. He was a close colleague of the late James Melvin Washington, editor of the collection Conversations with God, Two Centuries of Prayers by African Americans. Quentin, in his introduction, James Melvin Washington speaks of being very moved by the prayers of the Jews at the synagogue where he worked with his brother as a young, as a kind of a young kid. And I wondered about that, since all the prayers in this collection are by Christians or have a kind of are set in the Christian tradition. I was just interested in that.
I think there are a couple of things. One was the often communal nature of the prayers he saw at the synagogue, and the sense of unity, the sense of direct connection and conversation with God that he talked about, that he experienced there. And I think also just the idea of being able to understand the people with whom he had such close contact better through, you know, getting a glimpse of their actual encounters with God themselves. So seeing those prayers, I think, were very important for him. I want to get back, though, to something that Daniel said, a caller earlier, about the selflessness that he heard in the prayers. I wanted to make a comment about that. I think these African-American Christians early on recognized the distinction that Howard Thurman made, you know, years later between being a Christian and being a follower of Jesus. And they saw in their slave masters and some of the other examples around them of people who were considered themselves good Christians but weren't following the examples of Jesus. And so as following that example, selflessness, humility, all those things were things that were essential to being, you know, a true follower of Jesus.
I want to hear from some callers. Robert is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. It's interesting that there are a lot of people who are hearing our conversation who adhere to other religious traditions or don't have any religious tradition as part of their lives at the moment. I'm interested in what they, what inspires them or what helps them or comforts them and affirms them in times of distress. Robert, how are you? Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you. I'm not quite sure where to start. I think my head's about to explode.
Okay, let's hear it. Well, please don't explode.
Just the tone. But, I mean, as Social Boat was just said about the, you know, forgiveness of the slaves praying for their slave masters, that's not selflessness. That's buying into propaganda. I mean, you wonder why there are so few slave revolts in this country. See, that's exactly why. You don't have to worry about a slave revolt if you can beat your slaves down so much that they love you. It's kind of ridiculous. And the harm that the black church has done to the black community, especially the LGBT members of the black community, is insane. I mean, the number of prayers and sermons I've heard, you know, against them or, you know, telling people not to go to the doctor just to pray on it. You know, if you have a blood clot, you should go back to the doctor. Don't pray about it.
Okay. So let me ask you this, Robert. Let me just ask you this just to hone in on it. Is your view that religion can be a very destructive force as well, and that that's something, a point that you want to be sure is made?
It's not only that it's a destructive force, even if it's, you know, you're trying to use it for a positive force, you know, it's just my overall feeling that you can't make something positive that never happened in the first place. You know, if you look at the archaeological evidence, that story, the whole story of Exodus never took place. So you can't build something positive on something that never took place. You know, in the end, it'll fall apart. And I think that's what you've seen with the civil rights movement in this country. We've gone backwards instead of forwards. I think most people would say race relations have gotten much worse, or have not gotten worse, have just been exposed for what they've always been. And I'm not just blaming religion. I think, you know, religion is used as a crutch to kind of gloss over that, like you've heard before. Oh, isn't that so beautiful? Isn't that wonderful? That's not wonderful. That's, like I said, that's just buying, you know, someone who's so beaten down, they bought into the propaganda of their owner.
Well, thank you, Robert. I think that's an important point. So, Quentin Dixie, I'm going to ask you to address it. Obviously, you know, Robert has a point of view. Other people have different points of view on this. But I do think that going back to the question I had earlier, there are some people who have really put in the over in society overall, but interestingly, in the African-American tradition, have walked away from the church precisely for the reasons that, that Robert said. He feels that it encouraged passivity rather than action, you know, in the face of oppression. And I'd like to ask you to speak on that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that – thank you for that, Robert. I think on one hand, we have to try to understand this from the perspective of the people who are living it. And so what we're trying to present with the prayers – are stories about how people were able to endure suffering. And I don't think it's fair for me necessarily to judge how someone was able to get through a particular situation, whatever resources they use, spiritual or otherwise, to get through. So part of what we're doing here is documenting that. But by the same token, I think Robert is right that sometimes the intent on the part of those who were professing Christianity and giving Christianity to enslaved Africans may have been to subjugate them. But what's the more interesting story to me is how were they able to use that? And I think we have clear stories of, you know, instances where they were able to use that as a tool of empowerment. And so I think that's another strand. Just as we have this strand of Christianity that is, you know, has been historically oppressive and these things, we also have a strand, a tradition within Christianity that people have used as something that's liberative. So I don't think one necessarily completely cancels out the other. The other thing Robert mentioned, though, was how people within the African-American church have, from time to time, privileged their pain. And that's something that we have to work on and be mindful of, because you can find a way to say, okay, our particular circumstance, our particular situation is the worst, and no one's hurt the way we've hurt. And in doing so, you minimize the pain experiences of others. He mentioned gays and lesbians in African-American churches and how they've been preached at and not really loved, you know, as human beings. And so that goes back to the story of following the example of Jesus and making the distinction between Christians and those who follow Jesus.
Let's hear from Marshall in Augusta, Georgia. Marshall, welcome to On Point. Marshall, are you here? Oh, we lost him. Okay, Porter. Porter's with us from San Antonio, Texas. Porter, what's on your mind? Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle. Thank you for taking my call. I'm not against what the previous caller was saying, but for me, and I'm not trying to put myself, I'm a white male. I'm not trying to put myself in a position to understand the porn from the slave woman. But for me, it was so inspiring to me, just because in my own Christian walk, I see what a wretched sinner I am, and that I am saved by grace from an omnipotent, all-knowing, caring God who, I think we play up Easter about the crucifixion of God, but in Christmas, you know, God became a human to save me, and I didn't deserve that. And I think that's one of the things that just inspires me and gives me hope, and that I can hear from this woman is that not only we're in the discussion that people have been having, they're talking about the characteristics of God, who God is, but I think she sees that she is a wretched sinner, and only by the grace of God does she have, this understanding that gives her hope. And that just, to hear that just kind of inspires me. I'm not trying to say that I go through in any way those types of trials, but to have that hope and that grace in her situation just really puts me into my place, and just is really inspiring. And I appreciate hearing this, and I can't wait to go out and get a copy of this book. And I just happened upon y'all, and I just really appreciate that.
Well, Porter, thank you. We happen to appreciate you as well. Thank you for calling. Let's hear from Jessica in West Palm Beach, Florida. Jessica, welcome to On Point. What's on your mind?
Hi, Michelle. I just have to say that I completely agree with what Robert was saying about, you know, being a Christian or in any religion, it can have kind of it's like a double-edged sword. You know, you are conflicted in this position where you feel like you have to follow an example, but at the same time, you know, you're still praying and you're still trying to be a Christian. I am Hispanic and I am a Christian, but however, my family is very diverse. I have a lot of LGBT people in my family, and oftentimes they feel like they cannot be themselves, and they are Christians, and they feel that like they cannot be themselves or, you know, express anything from who they are because of the fact that they they are in a Christian environment. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that can go, that's kind of universal across the board, you know. Why do people pray for their football team to win, but they don't go to church, you know? It's kind of, I really feel like it's kind of a spiritual warfare conflict that as an individual you can go through, you know, being in any religion. But with that being said, I completely agree with what he's saying as far as, you know, any minority community that is involved in, you know, in the Christian culture, it's kind of very conflicting as an individual, but you still kind of want to hold on to that hope, you know. Is prayer transcendent among all these other things? Like, you know, is God transcendent? Like, it's kind of, it's really interesting, and I found that to be a very good point, what he was saying.
Well, Jessica, thanks so much for calling. What about Sharon? Sharon's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Sharon, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi, Michelle. My perspective, you asked for a perspective from people who maybe are not exactly Christian or following the Christian tradition. And I was raised Christian and often wondered how someone who did not have a faith would, you know, do good and things like that. And that was my immaturity in a lot of ways and my lack of exposure to others. But I began to attend and speak at a Universal Unitarian Church, and found, and that this community, and like others, invites lots of different people, whether it's pagan or whether it is Buddhist or Hindu or someone who feels not exactly as comfortable in their own tradition, but looking to expand or work with others. And we have people who identify as humanist or atheist. And so we get together, and there's a grappling. I love the word a wrestling to figure out, you know, how to work with each other, understand and learn about each other's faith, and, you know, respect it.
Is prayer a constant there, Sharon? Is prayer a part of your getting together?
We do prayers and meditations, and we do. And there is when we get together, there's like Thanksgiving. We had a Thanksgiving ceremony not too long ago, and it's a unification. The goal is unification, and then social justice is a huge part of it. So looking to see whose voice is not at the table, who does not have a chance to speak, and not trying to speak for them, which has been done so many times, but inviting them in and learning the language. And I'm not talking literal languages necessarily. You listen to the variety of jargon or languages used. I don't want to say jargon, but terms used by followers or non-followers of different religions. And it means so many different things to other people, especially if you're outside or have been harmed by a particular religion.
Can I ask you, before we let you go, Sharon, just very briefly, may I ask you briefly, can I put you on the spot?
Yeah, no, put me on the spot.
Is prayer still important in your life?
Absolutely, absolutely. And to me, it's an ongoing, active connection every moment, as well as formal prayers. And I love the prayers that were offered today.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for that. Just from one listener on Twitter, it's interesting that this is still a very kind of a controversial thing to talk about in a public way. But for some people, it's just not. And we have received a message from South Pole Elf, who says that prayer is truly the best way to get clarity, strength, and change. It's also affordable to all. God wants to bless us. Just ask. So thank you for that, South Pole Elf. So finally, Quentin, just one more final thought from you. What would you like us to draw from this collection? What would you like us to take away from it?
Well, I think what I really want to take away from this is that this is just a snapshot of how some African Americans have dealt with the burden of our history. And Dr. Washington really wanted people to understand that to him, this was a gift, right? How is it that African Americans have endured suffering and yet still been able to sing? Still been able to remain joyful. And so this is an invitation, if you will, for people to understand more about the African American experience, but to utilize that in such a way that it brings us closer together as a nation.
Quentin, can I put you on the spot?
Yes.
Do you pray?
I do. Not as much as my mother would like, but I do.
Well, that's all of us. Quentin Dixie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Quentin Dixie is director of the Ethnic and Cultural Studies Program at Indiana University, Purdue University at Fort Wayne. He was a close colleague of the late James Melvin Washington, editor of the collection Conversations with God, Two Centuries of Prayers by African Americans. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We are going to go out with a prayer that I am guessing is going to be very familiar to many people. It's Lift Every Voice and Sing. It's sung by the Harlem Boys Choir. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.